The Hilltop Glove Podcast is sponsored by Mid-Carolina Service Company.
Mid-Carolina Service Company is the first name to search for your residential or commercial HVAC needs in Lexington and surrounding areas.
Just go holler at Jason and Clint. They'll hook you up on the air conditioners, on the restaurant equipment, refrigerators, refrigeration, ice machine repair. They've been doing this for years. I know them cats forever.
Family owned and operated since 2006, they pride themselves in their quality work and customer relationships. Call 803-356-4153 or visit midcarolinaserviceco.com for no obligation quote for service today. This episode of Hilltop Glove Podcast is brought to you by the Simon Marketing Agency. Turn an ordinary business into an extraordinary one since 2020. Simon James and his team do the hard work of attracting new customers so you can focus on making your business exceptional. As a brand marketing expert, Simon specializes in creating a unique and unforgettable identity for your business. From generating awareness to captivating content creation and strategic advertising, Simon Marketing Agency has you covered. Elevate your business today. Give them a call at 843-942-8880 or email them at simon@smasimon.com. Visit them at www.simonmarketing.agency. Make sure to follow them on Instagram at BrandSimonTV.
This episode of the Hilltop Glove Podcast is sponsored by Bob's. Bob's is a Columbia-based retailer of over 100 Black-owned products from 20 Black-owned businesses. Bob's offers a wide range of items from household cleaning, cosmetics, and everything in between. With every visit to Bob's, you support the Black-owned businesses, giving them the opportunity to grow and establish connections with our community. Bob's is located inside the Noma Warehouse at 2222 Sumter Street in Columbia, South Carolina. Visit their website, WeShopBops.com, for in-store pickup or to find out more. Bops can also be found via social media on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at WeShopBops. When you stop by, tell them the Hilltop Glove sent you. Bops brings quality Black brands to the Columbia community. The Hilltop Glove Podcast is sponsored by True Brilliance Entertainment.
True Brilliance is a production, promotions, and management company dedicated to connecting artists and producers across the Carolinas to music industry professionals.
Several of their clients have placements both domestic and internationally as a result of their services.
Are you an artist or producer looking to build meaningful relationships within the music industry? Then True Brilliance is for you. Check them out at paramilitary.com. That's spelled P-A-I-R-A military.com.
Welcome to the Hilltop Glove Podcast.
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 Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Hilltop Glove Podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Mr. Tyrone Jeter. Mr. Jeter is a world-class artist, painter, sculptor, illustrator, and teacher. Recently retired associate professor of art at Benedict College, Jeter grew up in Anniston, Alabama, during a time defined by strict segregation laws and social justice. He received his Master's of Fine Arts from Ohio University in 1978 with an emphasis on painting and drawing. An exceptional draftsman, his portraits are sensitive, timeless, and masterfully executed. In 1979, Mr. Jeter relocated to Nigeria, where he lived for 7 years. While there, he drew and painted among the locals of northern Nigeria. During this time, he created numerous paintings that captured the richness and depth of the cultures of the region. This experience taught him to understand the natures of life in a society where life and nature are sometimes both hard and cruel. After returning to the U.S. in 1987, he began teaching at the University of Akron, where he transformed his experience in Nigeria into the most powerful work of his career. Mr. Jeter's works have been displayed at the Columbia Museum of Art, Florence County Museum, and Waterfront Gallery in Charleston, also the Center for Afro-American Artists in Boston. Thank you for joining us today. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Nice to see you again also. She didn't tell you. She's my former student.
Oh. I didn't put that in the bio. I didn't. We were going to come across that.
Yeah, it was a lot.
Well, you're a good student, though.
I don't tell people everything I've done, but, you know.
Tell them everything I've done.
Fair.
Yeah, you're right. Yes, Mr. Jeter used to be my professor at Benedict College, and I gave him the hardest time out of everyone. I can say that. Okay. I created a rebellion against him. When he wanted us to submit our work, I'm like, you guys, he can't fail us all if we don't do our homework. And literally, you know, he kind of did.
Oh,
so it didn't work.
That's just called wish fact.
It did not work.
Quite a few that semester, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. You taught us a lesson.
You know, pick which systems you try to burn down.
Yeah, that was the early, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just like, you know, all of us can come together. It wasn't a lot in our class. So I'm like, but we can all come together.
Some kind of unity.
It didn't work.
Union of people.
Yeah, we couldn't crack him. Okay, so just to get started, we'd like to give our guests a little bit of information about your background and upbringing. So can you tell us a little bit more about your childhood or what inspired you as a child?
I guess like most of us, I thought I had a unique childhood. Probably didn't. Also, almost all the women during that period of time was domestic workers. Most of the men were, well, laborers. They did various handyman type of things, you know. I grew up surrounded by women. You see the bulk of my work is about women. I was at a very early age, I was taught to respect, you know, women. And that's even in the South where it wasn't always that way. That's the way I was actually raised, to respect women. And sometimes it was emphasized through the hand.
They pinch you or they hit you or, yeah.
Oh, smack you.
Slap on the wrist.
Yeah, but it was all in fun, I guess, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my mother, like I said, she was a domestic worker most of her life. Very great education. Probably one of the most intuitive women you'd ever meet in your life. You know, she did a lot to keep me on that path to go the right direction. She was a lady who at times... No fault of hers. She left all of them, you know.
And what's her zodiac sign?
But she was very wise, you know, to leave all these people because they were not really good people. And at one point, she decided that she'd had enough Alabama. And she packed up her bags, left us with my grandparents, took off for Ohio. And at that point, it's what they call that underground, the railroad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she went there, stayed with her relatives.
Yeah.
It's mostly where it was done. And very not too far from the state line, you know, Kentucky, Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
So we stayed there. She stayed there for about 2 months, then sent for us. One sister, my older sister, was already married and out of the house. She was in Germany at the time, I think. And middle sister, she also came. So we moved there. I started school at Dayton Roosevelt High School. Are we getting into how I got involved with the arts also?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. Art for me started with my sister, the oldest one. If you've seen these comic books where these little things, they draw me. No. In these comic books, there were usually, you could find these little images, contests, they call it draw me contests.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was a lie. It was nothing. You were not going to win any prize. They wanted you to subscribe to it so they could make money off of it, you know. So my sister used to sit at the table and draw those all the time. And I used to watch her. And that was my first exposure to any kind of art, creative arts, you know, visual arts. The second influence was, you ever hear of Sweet Daddy Grace? God, you guys are young.
Look, they're older than me, and I'm like...
Sweet Daddy Grace was an evangelist out of Harlem.
Okay.
He must have 100,000 people that followed him. Super rich. They always get rich off of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And what he would do, periodically, he would send his ministers all over the country, and they would come to start new churches. So... One showed up in Anniston, Alabama. Grandmother and them got caught up in it. And they sort of adopted all of his meals. He would come to the house and have his meals there, you know, as he built this church. People couldn't see that, could you?
Yeah.
They couldn't see that. I forgot about that. Anyway.
That was air quotes.
I'll say in quote. What really was really interesting about this guy, his first day he got there, he asked my grandmother if he could pay her back through his trade, you know. So... That's sure. So they had these old metal cabinets in the pitching. This guy pulled out paintbrushes and he painted birds and flowers and all kinds of things on this. And I used to watch him. I was sitting there and just watching, but I was just fascinated. I was just a little kid, you know, probably around about 6, 7, something like that. You know, I used to watch him all the time. So that was the second influence. When my mother took us to Ohio, I got lucky. I ran into a really, she was not a good teacher, you know, but she knew what she was doing. She chose people that she thought had possibilities. So I didn't want to, at the time, I was dating a young lady who could drive a car and I couldn't. So I was more involved with trying to learn to drive than to do art. Mm-hmm. I was in her class and I was going to drop her class so that I could learn to drive because my girlfriend drove. Mm-hmm. And she called my mother and told my mother that she never talked to my mother before in her life. She called and said, you shouldn't let him drop.
Of course.
If you have to, I'll help you to get him a driver's training, you know. And so I never knew that for years when my mother finally told me that she had called her, you know. And those are the ways I stayed in drawing classes there. And that's how I should be out of art now. There was nothing in my past that would indicate I would become an artist. Because, I mean, there was nobody professionals around me when I was growing up. Maybe one art teacher, but there was nobody that I could have looked at and been inspired by, you know. But once my mother learned that I wanted to do it, she gave me no peace, supported me every step of the way. She's a great woman.
You are the only boy? Are you the youngest, too?
What's that mean?
I'm just reliving your story.
You know, we talk to all kind of people in this program, so we're always trying to see where people fit in the
spectrum.
It's got a comparison to our own lives. We got to see how people fit in there and how it influences them and such. But you know, a lot of times we record these in many different venues, but today we're actually in 701 Whaley, a contemporary center for arts, and we're in the gallery space upstairs that you have lot of your work in, and you're actually working on some pieces off to the side, and we've been kind of watching you as we set up. You know, this is one of the things that doesn't come across on podcasts, but I feel like I kind of have to talk about the space and what your art looks like if people are not familiar with it, because most of this is kind of monochromatic. It's like it's charcoal and chalk and pencil and I don't know, maybe some pastels as you go mm-hmm. through it. And then some of it gets into almost an installation piece. There's different elements and paper and old things that are sitting in front of the paintings, bicycles. And it's really, you know, I was walking around with my son before this and just, you know, there's a lot in every piece. And it's really enjoyable to go through. And, you know, they're not usually pretty pleasant scenes. A lot of it is thunderstorms and things going on in the background. It's very captivating. Every single one of these pieces, it just kind of pulls you in a bit. So, yeah. Very much enjoy your work. Thank you.
And that is, it's not gloomy because it's not into that.
No, it's not.
It's captivating. Yeah. It engulfs you. It kind of like, you can't just look at one piece. You just really just take your time and try to depict, decipher, okay, does he have any hidden messages in this piece?
Yeah, that's
a lot of hidden messages in each piece.
Yeah. Well, the first thing, when you look at my art, it insists that you feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't walk past my work and not feel something. I think that culture is sort of separates us from the other. I think we lose a certain amount of our humanity. My mother, when I was growing up, my mother taught me that a couple of stories. Come home from school. Mm-hmm. When I was in college, and I'm upstairs in my bedroom just painting something. She asked me, what was I doing? I told her, I said, well, I'm just sort of playing around with it. She said, well, I don't feel nothing from it. And I give her this
That's
funny
a nice
look.
Drawing, but yeah, it doesn't move me.
That was the spark.
This is my mother telling me something like she's about to encourage me. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, our family feel things. And I said, okay. I said, so what are you trying to say? She said, well, I'm trying to say I don't feel anything when I look at that. Mm. And I said, well, this art world doesn't like that. She said, then who are you? And now I'm really lost in this conversation because I don't know how to handle this, you know.
Right.
I never thought that deeply before, you know.
Right.
So I told her, I said, I'm your son. She said, no, my son feels. And just left the room, left me sitting there.
Call him out.
What I did was took that thing and put it aside and went back and started again. Mm. I knew that she would give me no peace for one thing, and she was right, you know. Mm-hmm. The second thing she taught me was that art has to take a stand, okay? She would come by when I'm working, and she would ask me, what was I doing again? That was a lead-in. I knew something was coming. She had been thinking about something. So I told her, well, I'm just working, you know. And she said, well, I'm looking at who is it going to help? Who is it going to help? It's just a work pain. I'm trying to learn how to do this. She said, well, it still could help somebody. And she said, well, I don't know. She said, well, it ain't going to help nobody. You shouldn't be doing it. And just left me there, you know. So that was another lesson. I need to think about who was I talking to, you know.
Yeah.
And the rest of my career was spent trying to learn to make a universal statement.
I can say that you did help figure out their why. Because I remember being a student in your class. Every time you would ask me a question, I would say, I don't know. And you were like, you do know, Tamaya. And I'm like, no, I don't. But I never like slowed down and processed it or even thought about the why. Was it going to help?
Sometimes we know why, but we don't know it from like a logical way. You know, it's not something that we can verbally, we know why. We just can't tell you why. That's why we're doing the art.
Yeah, it's a process of figuring out how to verbalize it to the world. Yeah.
And that's what it was. Yeah. You helped me verbalize things.
Since you keep bringing up, say this. No, it's nothing bad. But when I got the Benedict, it was just a different experience. I've never experienced anything like that. I mean, I was first told that the syllabus that I tried to teach you guys was too much for you, that you guys wouldn't be able to handle it, and I should dumb it down a bit. Didn't say that, but that's what she meant. So I revoked against that. That was the first time I got in trouble in the department when I did that. You know? After that, I was always in a little bit of trouble. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. So I refused to do that. And the second thing I had to do, not only get your attention, I had to get your respect.
Yeah.
And for what I had seen, students just got over. Mm-hmm. They got over continuously. And I knew I could teach them if I couldn't get them to listen. So I chose a different path. Everybody else was all friendly with students. It was like he was brothers and sisters and all that. I took a path that I'll eat you alive.
Yeah.
I say, you know?
You really did.
It's the only way I could get you to listen.
Yeah.
I remember when Sanford was in my class, it was the same type of thing. You know, Sanford, anything I told Sanford to do, Sanford had to question me. Rock bottom too, as he calls himself. Same thing. I was in a constant fight trying to get them to listen, you know?
Yeah.
And the only way I could do it was just to not take any nonsense, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I never taught like that before in my life, but I didn't have a choice. But that was, I taught at Benedict. Later on, after you guys left, I reached a point where I either retired or just gave in because I was tired.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were tired of being
I was
enforcing.
You know, I got better students at times, but it was still too many students. They were not getting anything out of these classes. Yeah. And to pay that much money, not be able to get into your field, it was horrendous. I'm probably going to get in trouble. Anyway,
I mean, it's not just them. That's kind of higher education as a whole right now. Right. They've gotten really good at that machinery. Gosh, I mean, trying to go to college for fine arts to me, like, you know, because I went for graphic design, which is a curriculum, you know, like there's a thing there. But I can't even imagine trying to build a program inside of that environment. It's about coin now.
Yeah.
When we were going to school, it was a little bit different because it was so difficult for us to get in school. Now, almost anybody can get in. That's the thing, you can stay, but you can get in. I was the second person in all of my family to go to college, okay? And I went to college. My mother worked for this white lady as a domestic worker. God, it must have been 10 years. And when I came of age to go to college, she went to see the lady, and she said, I want you to give my son a year of college. He had to do it on his own.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I really can't. I mean, three boys myself, and I just don't have the money to do it. And this lady owned this big factory, a big, huge company. She was doing just fine. So my mother said, well, you know that I worked for you all these years. You never paid me Social Security, anything.
You
know, that money you didn't pay me, just send my son to school for just 1 year. That's how I went to college. My mother.
Wow.
My mother
she sacrificed a lot. She
your
fought
mother
for you.
Sounds like an amazing person.
Yeah.
She was an amazing woman. I tell everybody about it, you know? when I traded that for the world, when I lost, it was like, anyway. What was your real question you asked me?
I don't even remember.
This is the real question. You got to this place and how you learned the things, and I feel like we're doing that.
Yeah.
You was asking about the show, I think, the content of the show.
Sure.
Yeah. Almost everything I do, it has something in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like that show at the museum, Enduring Spirit, I wanted to put an S on the end of that word, but that would have made it, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. And it was an opportunity, a chance for me to try to pay tribute to women in my family, in my past, and in my neighborhood. And so it was a chance to talk about the things they had done, the influence they had on my life. I mean, when we were growing up, they caught me doing something 5 blocks down the street. They would grab me by my ear and pull that switch off that tree and whip my behind.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't say, I'm tell my mother what you did. You don't do that.
Really?
They took you straight home. Say, girl, you don't know. I had to whip this boy's behind today, you know?
I took care of it for you, but if you need to do it again, go ahead.
It ain't no taking care of it. My mother said, boy, you done embarrassed the family out there.
Oh.
What is wrong with you? Get in the house. She's not, before you go get that switch.
And you got to beat it again?
You have to go and get another second.
That was for embarrassed.
Now you did something wrong. You got whipped for that. Now you're getting whipped for embarrassing family. So she would send you out. Get that switch. And you know how we are. We come back with a thing like that.
Yeah.
She's sending you right back out. Get a second one, you know? And she would send you out to get 3 switches.
Mm-hmm.
When she got them all back, she would braid them.
Wow.
You thought you were being slick. She would braid those switches, you know? But they never hit me in a place where it would ever show or that would really hurt me, you know? Like if I had short pants on, she would whip me on my behind, but she wouldn't hit me on the legs.
Yeah.
And there's that painting down there with the lady with the branch in her hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that's about.
Really?
You know, James Brown put that song, Mama Come Here Quick, and bring in that licking stick.
Uh-huh.
That's what she's got there. She's like Mother Nature, and she's looking at all of these people, the things we've been doing, just trying to decide whether she's going to whip our behinds or she's going to give us another chance, you know?
Mm. Give us our grace.
Yeah. Mm. So this show here is primarily about climate change.
Really?
Yeah, it's primarily about climate. That's why you see all these things dealing with skies and isolation of kids. But what I was trying to do, I wanted to put a different spin on it. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to talk about was that if parents don't take this serious, your kids are in serious trouble because this culture exploits children. The whole world exploits children. There's nobody to protect them. They get exploited. You know, and if we don't stop this thing, we're in trouble because don't see nature as being mad, angry at us, you know?
No.
I think what she is doing is resetting.
Yeah.
We've almost destroyed the world. Mm-hmm. She's doing is resetting this thing back, putting it back the way it was. If we get hurt by that, that's on us, you know? We did this thing to ourselves. But at the same time, too, what the positive thing I get from this, I try to put out there, is that when you go back, you look at the first time the world was so destroyed, dinosaurs was wiped out, you know? Mm-hmm. Only a few actually will just survive, you know, things like that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But children will survive. We know, science has taught us so much in this head, this brain, that we don't touch. We don't even know what it's for. It's just sitting there.
Yeah.
What if these kids?
Right.
Yeah.
Then you've got a whole new thing, ball game going here, you know. This one here, right there on that corner right there, that's what that one's about. Little boy is tapped into his brain. That nobody ever sees. And fires, you know. This little girl up here is with the hair going up in the air like that.
Yeah.
She has nature, move things. Yeah. Make her hair shoot up in the air like that, you know.
There are several of these where the hair just kind of turns into these flowy waves, kind of an energetic thing going on. There's several of them that happens with.
That's another story. When I was back in the 80s, I lived in West Africa. My wife was Nigerian, and both my girls was born there. So I lived there for 7 years, and hair there is not a problem, okay? Nobody teases you about your hair going all kinds of ways. And
of course.
You know? Nobody does. So my kids would get their hair washed. They'd go outside and play and let it dry faster, they said, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We got back to the States. We're living in Akron. My daughter, her mother washes her hair. She said, Mom, I'm going to go ride the bike until my hair dries. She went outside and the kids just harassed her mercilessly. And to me, it was like a loss of innocence, you know?
Sure.
And so it it was, I bet it was 10 years before I even brought that back in my head and started doing it with the head. That's what I mean by the subconscious.
Yeah.
Everything I do, it depends on what the subconscious tells me. Like, if it doesn't talk to me, I don't do anything.
Yeah.
I will just sit around and lump it out, you know?
Yeah.
Watch TV all day. That's what I'd be doing. But everything touches me. Everything affects me. You know, my mother taught me that, like we said, about emotions and stuff like that. So everything touches me. So something I'll see something, or someone would say something, and it would trigger this thing. It would start to think about it. And it can keep me awake doing that, you know? And it would run something past me. If it was a good idea, I'll sit and wait still until I find the right centerpiece. You know, if it's not, part of your mind throws it out. So that's stupid. Go away. But it comes back. If it's
still
good
there.
Idea.
Yeah.
It would come back slightly changed. You know, I trust that completely, completely, because I don't do sketches. I build mine. All these things are built. As much as I told you guys, do sketches.
I used to hate doing sketches. And Mr. Jeter was like, a true artist just does it. Just put your hand on the paper and just draw. And I'm like, what do you mean?
Sure.
But I just grew up draw. Sketching.
Yeah.
I grew up sketching. Once I how I worked, then I could throw that aside, you know?
Right.
And even till today, I don't sketch. Everything in here is built by waiting for that voice and then finding that centerpiece that set that whole composition on edge, you know? And then I will start it, and all these things are built around it.
Well, how vulnerable do you have to be to actually, like, each piece? Like, how vulnerable do you have to be with each piece?
Well, my mother taught me that you can feel and protect yourself at the same time. You don't have to just go into it in any kind of relationship where you're just so wide open, people abuse you. If somebody's abusing you, get up and get the fuck out of there, you know? You don't have to sit there and take that. And her thing was that you trusted people until they blow it, you know? I mean, you don't trust them with your life. You don't give a guy a knife and say, I trust you not to kill me. And you know he's going to kill you.
Assume the good until you show otherwise.
Yeah,
but that's where I was raised. My work is that way because of that, you know? I don't have any problem, but because, and the way I work, whether stuff is good or bad, whether it's artistically sound, I don't know. Somebody else would make that determination.
No, it is.
But the thing is, though, because of the way I work, I can change direction just like that. I can't pop my finger very well, you know, but I can change direction just like that.
Yeah.
And all this stuff is results of that. You see that bottle, that big green bottle?
Mm-hmm.
I found that bottle in an antique shop. Not antique, it's just a junk shop they call antique.
Sure.
So I found that bottle. It's hand blown. It was just a nice bottle, so I bought it. And I bet I had that thing 7-8 years before I even did anything with it. And it was been on a, used to draw that bottle.
Still life.
For still life, you know. So this thing was sitting in my studio. It'd been there for years, you know. And then I bought that little stand for some reason. Don't know why. And those two things sat in there another year.
Yeah.
I have quite a bit of junk in my studio and house, you know. So one day I wanted to get it off the floor. So I just set it in that, excuse me, I set it in that stand there. And I saw a pregnant woman. Just like that, I just saw a pregnant woman. And then it popped at me what they're saying about everybody has to have a child. If you get pregnant, you can be 2 years old. You have to have the baby. And the little girl is up top. That's talking about that. They would make a child have a baby, even if she's raped or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's about an abortion. All of us are kids. I'm going to have to do more to that. I don't want them to be all pink.
Okay. See, if you didn't explain that, I wouldn't have thought that.
Mm-hmm. No, I want them to be. That's what it's about. This one over here, the one in the middle, is about a drought. When I was in West Africa, I was in Kano one time, and this guy told me, he said, this Kano was built on a desert. And he said, every year they lose a mile, they have to reclaim it, it takes it back. You can't beat nature.
Mm-hmm.
You can't beat it. You can put up all these things. Eventually, if you don't take care of nature, she takes care of you. So this was about that. I found that baobab tree. I drew that in West Africa. It was in my drawer. I forgot it was even there. And I found that little frame-looking thing there. I think it's a flower box or something. I found that someplace years ago. I just liked it. Brought it into the studio and stayed there. And then one day, I was going to the drawer, and I saw that. And it just, that would work.
It made sense.
So I went out and got that. And it was just Then I was out at some so-called antique shop once, and I ran across that column. I could just picture that column sitting underneath it. And the last thing, the last two things, I sit underneath there, there was a hole already there, and I was out walking around the lake, and I walked past that thing, and I just saw it and kept right on walking, got all the way home, and stopped. I had to go back and get it. But I came back and dropped, and it was just perfect. And then the last thing I did just before I brought it over here, I bored a hole in there and dropped that branch in there. In real life, though, nature would grow that thing right out, and she would grow that thing right back. But that's the way nature works.
Yeah.
It sounds like you do a lot of collecting things as you go along, and you find something that for some reason you're drawn to it, and you don't even know why. And I'm thinking about this because very recently, like, I had to do a purge on my house because I just had all these random bits and bobs that just made it into my home for some reason. You know, they were things that a former employer had been decorating his office with, and things that somebody else's grandfather, you know, just stuff that was energetically dense, but it wasn't mine.
I built a storage room. I'm still paying for it, of course. But I built the storage room outside just so I could keep more stuff, because I know this stuff is there for a reason.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And you, when you find like a faucet, you have like a reason that you need to turn around and go back and get it.
Yeah, because this thing popped in my head. When I saw that faucet on the road, it just popped in my head and was all rusted out, which is what I wanted, you know. Right. And I saw it. I had no idea where it was holding. I would have bored a bigger hole if I had to. But I just dropped it in. I keep stuff.
That kind of reminds me of like our next question. Like, what is your definition of the shared experience?
What I'm doing now. A shared experience, you know, like I was trying to say that I don't know why it was so difficult for me to understand how to make a universal statement to speak to any and everybody and get past the fact that these are black figures.
Mm-hmm.
I paint black figures because I know black people, and so I didn't always know how to talk to people. And during the 60s, I tried that thing of showing police and all that stuff, but I hated it because what I believe is that if you scream at people, they'll stop listening.
Yeah.
You can't keep telling a guy, people did this, they did this. You got to show them some other things, you know, and make them come to that conclusion too. So I learned that. Those are lessons that builds up over time, you know. So done this drawing, it was a triptych. It was in a show down at Lake City. And down there, I think it was opening or something, you know, I went down for that. And back, because I hadn't seen it since they hung it. I walked back by so I could see how they hung it, you know. And there must have been 15 people standing in front of it. Black, white, Hispanic, children, you name it. They were there. And they were discussing that piece. So I stopped and pretended that I was there to discuss it too. This was about domestic workers.
Oh, wow.
Mm. And it was because of the nation's last in-house servant, I think, or something like that, you know. Anyway, I was listening to them, and everyone had a shared experience with that. The little girl said, I remember my mother used to come home. She used to bring these bologna sandwiches. We used to stay up all night just to eat that bologna, you know? And they were always, everybody started laughing. And everybody there had done that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's they could actually talk about that. And all of a sudden, the light just went on. One of the other pieces over there show about pregnant women. These two women pregnant with this little boy in the middle. You remember that one. That was a shared experience also, because we had to talk. The thing that the women mostly talked about was that the piece was about a woman bringing women bringing children into the world, and how do you got a big, especially a young black male, his life is in jeopardy from the time he gets into the world, you know.
Yeah.
Not saying anything different about women, the same thing. It's seen that they get shot more. Although you guys are trying to catch up.
Yeah.
You shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But so those for me is how I share experience. And I try to find that thing that people relate to. Now, I think I've succeeded. I can tell you why. When I had the show at the museum, every day I went in there, security was waiting on me. And they gave me a running report on what happened during the show that day. I bet you every day I went through there, somebody had been crying. And then people come through here, the same thing they say, bring tissues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're getting the message that I'm talking about. Whether they are into climate change or not, they're getting the message, you know. I'm hoping they're into climate change, you know. But what you do is you come up with your statement and you do it as well as you can.
Mm.
You try to find that piece that allows people to enter. You don't put something like a cop with a foot up in the air getting ready to stomp on a man, you know. You don't put something like that in there because they're not going to look at it long.
Right.
Right.
You can't even look at that long. Yeah. Right. You know? It's a futile message. One you see all the time, what he's painting a lot now, Black Love. That's the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. You would never see me do that, you know. I think they're just cliches.
Yeah.
You know? They're making men and women relationship, and it's like a cliche. Mm-hmm. And people, it's just so beautiful.
Black Love, hashtag.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I try to avoid the obvious statement. I try to give them a chance to enter the work. Mm. I try to release them. Mm. If you look at these long enough, I don't think anybody think they're gloomy.
Mm-hmm. No, they're not.
Yeah, hope.
They're very intense. And, you know, I mentioned the storms and stuff, but all of them are pretty much all portraits also.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're emotionally intense. Not really sad, but like with, the eyes are piercing. Like you look at some of these things and they're real people. And like this one that's behind you right now, like now that we're talking about is climate change, you know, there's obvious, like his shoulder is turning into a smoke behind there. And then what I interpret as smokestacks in the background, but then he's also wearing a t-shirt, just got a T-Rex on the front of it. Yeah. And so there's this extinction. Yeah. Like I see your message now, that, huh? I'm getting it. Yeah. Right. And, you know, and the same kind of thing with, you know, like his hair is spiky, but it is doing something energetic that is not what actually happens in the physical world. And so it's like it does. It draws you in. It is very intense.
And it's also like that electrical shock when hair stands up on your head.
Right, right. Like, alert. Yeah, like a staticky thing. Yeah. And there's a lot of lightning, a lot of energy in all of this, actually.
All that is just built. I get an idea. The idea that popped in here was about Breathless, you know, and popped in there. And it just sits there as it develops, you know. I find the right face. All these people here from Gambia, all of them on this side, all these black and whites are Gambians. I was there for about 6 months. I'm going back. Husband's from there. My kids were born there, you know. Well, part Gambian. That one back there talks about the bicycle, the tricycle. It's a simple concept. Is that this is a kid trapped outside, no one to come to get him. And there's an impending hurricane behind him. And the bike re-emphasized that point. There's nobody to come to get him. Mm-hmm. The bike has just been sitting there for years, rusted out. Mm-hmm. That's what that's talking about.
Mm. Talk about the shrines. The shrines.
The altars.
The altars and the shrines.
Which one you consider the shrine?
I see shrines in everything nowadays.
But choose one you want to talk about then. What about the one at the back? The big one. Not the other one, another one. Any one you want.
So much to look at.
You didn't reach your own stuff? I'm sorry, just teasing you. I couldn't resist that.
You like to pick.
Oh, I like teasing you. I like to, you know.
You've got one on the opposite wall over there that's got a, you know, it's an actual physical tree with the roots still attached. It's pulled out of the ground. And that connects the ground, and then it transforms into the painting. That actually has the tree coming out of the person's head, and there's two jars and boxes on either side. I was very curious into that.
Oh, it's two of them over there like that.
Oh,
there's two different ones on the other wall, right around the corner from it. Yeah, the big tall one, and then there's one around the corner. Those two were pretty much about the same time. I was trying to talk about the connection between man and nature, and I use the trees a lot for things like that. You know, I really like working with those trees, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, to thinking about it, but if that's the case and we keep cutting down trees and destroying trees, what's going to happen? So I decided, I found these really, those some nice bottles at Goodwill, I think, you know, and I bought the bottles. I didn't know what I was going to do with them. And then once I had done that piece, I ran across those bottles again. My work is never finished until it's out of the house, sold and gone, you know. Otherwise, I'll keep working. So when I saw those bottles, I decided that what if I went underneath my sink and started picking things up underneath the sink and poured into the bottle. So I put some dishwasher. There was some disinfectant I found in there. There's a bunch of stuff. I don't even know what all this stuff was. I put it in the bottle. And when you first put it, it's beautiful. It really is. It's shiny and sparkling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And about 2 weeks later, it's that stuff. And it keeps getting worse. So this is what...
Oh,
see, this is exactly
full circle. Yeah. You know,
that's very
because we dump that stuff all over the place and it's killing everything. We don't even think about saving trees or anything, you know.
No, they don't.
Because, I mean, every place you go, they just quack, quacking trees and put up some prefabricated house. They can charge a small fortune for it.
Something that's not going to last 50 years.
Yeah.
Like, some advice for other artists that are struggling and trying not to conform. What is some advice that you would give them to stay true to themselves?
Good job. That's what I did. Get a job.
Not art job?
Whatever pays your bills. You know,
but something to liberate you into now, this process.
If you're wise, if they're still young, go back to school, get your master's. The master's open up the university for you. And for an artist, that's the best possible job you can have. You teach, except for Benedict, you teach a couple days a week, and you have all that time to do your work. Mm-hmm. You do that 5 days a week, so you have to really, really be prepared, you know. I actually liked it when I first started, because once in a while, you see that light go on somebody's head, and boy, that teacher would die for that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Would die that, you know. Yeah. But that allows you to do the work. It is, I don't care who you are, nobody does art doesn't have money to eat and to pay. Nobody. You can't survive like that, you know. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to find some way to live. And don't waste your time and your opportunities, you know. And the other thing, too, that gets me is that give up that time freely. We are very generous with that, you know. A student come up to you and ask you something. You talk to them. You sit there and you talk the next hour as long as they're interested, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you would tell them that you say, why don't you try this on your work, you know, because most of them I tell them you should go nowhere without images of your work, you know. That's what these phones are for. So when you see the artist, if he's willing to look at your work, to him, he would make comments. And at the same time, if he spends time with you, say you should try this, he expects you to go do it. If you don't do it, then don't come back. That meant we wasted our time, you know. So the kids that come back, another session. You use everything that's around you that's open, you know, that's going to help you, you know. But the main thing is to realize that this is a tough field. Most of the time you're by yourself. You know, you're going to be by yourself. You're not going to be able to make every party that comes up. You're not going to be able to wear the finest clothes. You know, same all these trends that people buy, and you're better off keeping them in the bank than buying a new sweatshirt, you know. So that's the best thing you can do is just get that job that allows you to do, because I work part-time for anything just to keep from taking a full-time job. All the reason I took a full-time job was because I had children. Once I had children, it just changed the whole thing, you know? Yeah. So then I went back to teaching. I've worked that job. I worked one job where they clean these big old 50-gallon drums.
Yeah, big barrel.
They used to clean them, big metal things, heavy as a Dickens, you know? Paint them, you have to set them up, load trucks, you know, and that's by hand. You just have to stack them three high. I know you don't think I could do that, but God, I mean, anything that allowed me to be able to do the art.
Yeah.
It's that time, that extra time to put into it was that commodity.
You do it, you know what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about.
You can't do it and have 40-hour week jobs. Yeah. You're done.
All these things you're doing, somebody got to be paying you something.
Yeah.
True. You know, because you have to eat, because if you don't eat, you are not going to do any art.
Yeah.
I don't care what anyone says.
Right.
Yeah. You might have a couple of days, but it's over. It catches up with you, you know. So that's about all you can actually tell them. And just work. Listen to anything anyone tells you. Don't have to do it. I mean, you can have a drunk off the street tell you something about your work. You should listen.
Yeah.
If he thought enough of you to say something about it, you should listen. Mm-hmm. Now, you weigh it. Look back and forth what he's saying. And if what he's saying is true, because you should know, do it. Otherwise, you're thinking. Mm-hmm. But that's what you should do. You should never dismiss people. I mean,
You know, human experience and emotion is not something that, you know, like, there's no
single
there's no yeah, there's no tiered system to that. Like, any random person can experience
the most deepest,
intensest things.
Especially if you're pretending to be talking to people.
Yeah.
If I don't listen, then I'm one of the biggest liars you ever see in your life, because all I want to do is communicate. Mm-hmm. Normally, go to a lot of things, you know. I never had any use for it, you know. I'd rather be in the studio most of the time, and I don't have the great raps that I'm sure you run into a ton of people with great raps. You learn to ignore them, you know, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But I'm not like that, you know. And this is a chore for me. So you just learn how to do just enough to run your career, you know, which I'm not that great at that. Also, tell them to learn to run their career. Social media, and understand it, how to use it for your good. And I think probably ignore Facebook. It's not good for this, you know, bad for it. So just ignore Facebook, go into something else, you know, and just learn to use that computer because you're going to need it, you know, you're going to need it. I don't know what else I would tell you about that, but the main thing is just to believe that you can do this, you know, no matter what, no matter what anyone tells you, you can do it. People say some awful things to me. When I first went to college, I had a teacher, he gave us to go out twice a week. He told us to go out and make about 7 to 10 paintings, just small things, see what you could do. So I drew 7 to 10 black people, mostly, you know. So I brought it back in, and he praised it. And one white kid said, well, why is he just painting black people? And the teacher switched. Yeah, why are you doing that? You should paint more diverse things. I sat there, and I said, may I speak now? Let me tell him why. I said, I'm looking at your work. What do you paint? Landscape, all white kids, you know. And I told the professor, I know your work too. You don't paint black people. You don't paint any other body but white people, you know. I said, so let's put it like this. The thing you can discuss with me about my work is purely technique. You don't have that to say with my content.
Right.
Well, that's what we did.
I think that's the difference. If people don't discuss technique, they discuss content. That's what the world is doing.
Right. That's right. And they're judging you if you're not doing what they're doing.
Yeah. Or what their eye wants to see. Mm-hmm. And that's not fair.
That's been set by galleries and museums doing that kind of thing, making people do things like that, you know. But I just never conformed.
But talk about that. Like, okay, being an artist, how do you get your work into certain galleries?
I'm competent. First thing, I'm a really competent artist. That's what, you know, I used to tell you guys that I know as much technique as you can. Once you know that, you're free. Mm. You can do anything you want to do then.
Not like you're asking to be in this gallery. Mm-hmm. Your technique speaks for itself.
See, in a studio, you're running situations where a drawing won't work for this great idea you got.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you got all these skills, you can switch around and go to 2, 3, 4, 5 of them, you know, till you get the right technique, because it will tell you when you got the right one. So that for me, that's extremely important.
Having that toolkit that you can go to.
That's how you get there. You gotta know your field first. Otherwise, there's some people you see them now painting with spatulas and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, palette knives.
Yes. The palette knife is one thing, but for cleaning off windows, they're putting paint down. Now, if you think about that, that's a limited painting. Sooner or later, you run out of those. What you can do with that?
Right. Thing. It's a novelty that you can do it with this.
It just ends. So now you out there and you don't have any other skills, and you're just stuck. So you fade pretty fast, you know.
No longevity in the field. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So that's why you have to make sure you can say, this guy did not give me a chance because of this, that, or the other. If your work is just bad, then you can say. But if you know your work is good, you know, you've done your homework. Yeah, you can argue with them, because you can walk into a gallery and you see this stuff. They reject you. You know, you walk in their gallery later on and you look at what they got in there, and it's crap. You know it's crap. You see? Mm-hmm. But they just read good work. What does it tell you? It has nothing to do with your work.
It's not a fit.
You're just not copying what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Down this way, this one guy from the museum, he told me that you're going to have the trouble the rest of your life trying to get your work out this. Why is that? He said, because they can't pigeonhole you. They can't say, well, this work can be looked at, follow a trail of his work all the way from 10 years ago, this artist influence. Mm-hmm. And he told me that they can't do that, so you're going to catch the devil. And he's been right, you know, because...
Like, it's almost easier if they can talk about the lineage that you're there, because then there's, like, more chat about it.
Curate, like, especially when they're giving the speech,
I would never have thought about that. Makes total sense.
But your work, every time I see it, I know it. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's Mr. Jeter. Like,
well, I do have a way of saying what I say, don't I?
Yeah. Loud and clear, Mr. Jeter. Loud and clear. Now, what about pricing? Like, how do you price your pieces? And, each is different sizes.
Because when I was teaching, when I first got the Benedict, student was charging more for that work than I was, you know? And I said, well, you know, if you can get it, okay, you know, but I think... You start charging thousands of dollars. You need to know one thing is fundamental. You need to know that painting or that drawing will last 150 years if the buyer takes care of it. You don't put a drawing on cheap paper. You don't do anything with cheap. You're charging big money for your work. You know? You make sure that you have done what you're supposed to have done in integrity of the work. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Charge. You're thinking about your work. Mm-hmm. You have to get into what other people are thinking about it. Are you getting shows? And where are you getting shows? If you're still showing in libraries, things like that, small local galleries, you know, writers, you know, then it's hard to say, well, I want $5,000 for this work. It's hard to say that because mm-hmm. there's nobody validating you.
Right.
You start to charge in $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 and upward. You're talking about museum shows. The thing is, somebody wants it bad enough, you ask what you want for it.
Right.
But it's just a guideline that you should think about before you do that, you know. And there's a whole school that thinks that you sell it cheap to get it out there so everybody got your work and that makes you well known. Not necessarily true. Mean just gave away your best work if you ever become anybody in the arts. More than likely, the people that bought it, it's never going to do anything with it. They might have collected those pieces there, but it's going to hang on a back wall back there someplace. They're never going to ask to be asked to show it another show. So they don't have the chops to build up your reputation. So you just gave the work away. That's one reason why I work. I never want to give my work away.
Right.
I believe that sooner or later, even now, I don't say like other artists, you know, from it, you know, there's probably at least 2,000 artists in this city that sells way more work and probably higher than me, you know, but still, I believe in my work. And I tell my daughter, say, you may not make it now, but you get it later. And they know how to deal with my work. They'll never give it away, especially one in New York. She will never give the work away, you know, so it'll be fine. I have to mention her book.
Yeah. Talk about it.
Yeah, well, you'll be here when she comes on the 5th of August. She's going to speak here. I'm convinced that she should pay me back. But when she was a kid, she used to come in the studio with me and draw. Boy, oh boy, I was so happy. Probably be able to work with my daughter. I was like LeBron. Told me I play on the same team with my son. Unfortunately, that might be in jeopardy now. But I was thinking like that, you know. We can do shows together, all kinds of stuff. So one day, was this guy, the writer, Pat Connolly, is it
Conroy?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, famous writer, Conroy. He came to that school. And you know how the teachers are, they make them all write something and give it to him, and the guy never reads it. He goes away, and you never hear back from him. He called her, on the phone, talked to her about 10, 15 minutes. He told us, I just got through reading what you wrote. And she, I don't... She was just spellbound because they knew he was somebody big.
Right.
So I said, I've read it, and I think you should continue to write, you know? You have a lot to say. So when they got off the phone, she came in and told me, she said, I don't think I'm going to do art anymore. It hurt, really hurt. You know, I said, why? She said, well, I just don't want to do that. I said, come on, you can tell me why. She said, well, I want to write. Said, you want to write what? She said, poetry. And my head did this because I know poetry. You get about $30, $40 a poem if you get it published. So she said, I want to write poetry. I said, why? She said, well, you don't make any money with your work, you know. And they're in a private school. They're in a private school for them because we couldn't get into a good school in our neighborhood, you know. Mm-hmm. So she tells me that. And I said, okay. See, we had made an agreement with them. As long as they did well, no matter what they want to do, we would support them.
Mm-hmm.
Any school they want to go to, we would support them, okay. And so I was stuck with that, you know. So writing. She was right. She was definitely right. You know, when she came out of college, she worked at a job, but then she got this job as an editor with Amazon.
Wow.
Okay.
Oh, she was good. And they came after her, you know, she can really write.
Okay.
Paid her more than I could, prices what I was making probably, you know, and stock and all that stuff. You know, she worked there about 2 years and then just quit. I said, why would you quit? She said, well, she was trying to do this book on Black Lives Matters. They agreed to do it. They settled with all these editors in the office. So they wouldn't let her choose. Like she had Jabbar lined up to write the foreword for the book.
Okay.
It's going to do an article. So she had really thoughtful, radical people was going to do the writing. They wouldn't let her do it, you know. So she told them, she said, well, I'll be leaving. I did the same thing, University of Akron, you know. So I understood it, you know. And so she left. She has this knack for getting jobs.
Mm-hmm.
She left that, and she worked a couple of jobs there. She freelanced for a bit. Then she got this job offer from it. I think it's the biggest, one of the biggest agencies in New York. And she met the guy, she said, about 5 years before, and that he had been trying to get her to come for the longest. So he offered her a job again, and they handle artists. Writers.
Oh, okay.
He told us, you don't have to start at the bottom. You can start up here with me. Yeah. I'll give you some of my clients, you know. He bought up all the contracts. I mean, the stock from my own for, you know. Yeah. That's where she works now.
Wow.
She still does.
Good.
Yeah. Okay. So, good. Yeah, she had been working on that thing. For her first book was Un-American.
Yeah.
This one here is The Black Period. And it's, you know, you shouldn't read it. You shouldn't read it. She talks about her family a lot, you know. I'm sorry, brother, because you know enough about me and already. But she does. She talks about the family a lot. You know, the lessons she learned from the family, all that stuff. You know, it's a good book. It's won two awards so far.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And then I think it was last I heard was up for another one.
Her autograph.
Yeah, I know.
She'd be on the 5th.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
I have work in it. So I think. I don't know how she got them to put 60 pieces of art in that. I don't know how she did it. She did.
Okay.
I think they really wanted a book. When that happens, you can. Pretty much getting by doing
do what
you want. Yeah.
Want me, you got to include this.
Yeah. But it's real good. It's real good.
Being a full-time artist, how do you handle work-life balance? How do you balance, you know, your health, but also still putting all that you can into your each
piece? Well, you
piece?
Know I'm retired, right? Now, I've had a bunch of health issues, you know, a whole bunch of them, you know, but it's something about those health issues that always get a warning. Always, you know, I had the heart thing, you know. My wife had died a month before, and Jamila was the oldest one, was in school in England, okay, at the University of Leeds, had to make her go back, and then the youngest one was at Clemson. So I'm laying in bed one morning, somebody inside of my chest scratching from inside.
Yeah.
It was weird. So I called a doctor, went out there, and I was lucky he had an appointment open the same day. I went out there. And he looked and looked and looked, couldn't find anything. So I'm leaving in the car, giving me a drive away. He comes out and stops me. He asked me if I ever had that stress test. I told him no. He said, let's just do that just for the heck of it. He calls the clinic for an appointment. And they told me first, oh, it'd be at least 3 weeks, you know, before we can get him an appointment, you know. So he said, okay. So he made that appointment. And then just before he left, the lady called back and said, we just had a cancellation. So, and this was just incredible, you know. So I went the next day on the stress test. The doctor asked me to, after I took the test, he looked at the results. So at this time, I'm really messed up in here because I just lost my wife, you know, about 20-some years, you know. And so I'm sitting there waiting. I'm out there about 20 minutes. Nobody says anything. So I stop a nurse and I told her, look, this doctor had me sitting here for 25 minutes now and I want to go home. Could you please tell him I'm still out here? Otherwise, I'm just going to walk out. I'm mad now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So. Goes back
not about me. Yep.
And the doctor tells me to come back there. And I met this guy a long time ago. My wife knew his wife, you know. I met him a long time ago. So we were talking. And he was saying, well, me and my partner, we looked at the charts, you know. We think everything is okay. So getting ready to leave. So well, that's good because that stress test almost killed me out there, you know. He looked at his partner. And he looked back at me. And he tells me, see, if you were my brother, we'd be taking you to the hospital right now. That's what they did. Go home and pack a bag, take me to the hospital. And the next morning, I was in surgery. I had about 90% blockage.
Wow.
Got a triple bypass there. Last summer, not this past one, before that, I was in the Gambia. I was coming back. I caught a cold, I thought, you know. God, I was coughing like mad, you know. And if COVID had been there, it'd kick me off the plane, I'm sure.
Right. You know, right. We changed our sensitivities on such things. Yeah.
Well, I took some codeine and that sort of knocked that out a little bit, knocked me out too, you know. But anyway, when I got back, I stayed at my daughter's house for a couple of days and she got concerned, took me to the hospital. They told me I had walking pneumonia. Ooh. So they gave me medication. When I got home, they told me to go and see my doctor. So that night when I got home, I started coughing so bad I was coughing up blood. So I got in the car and drove to the emergency. When I got there, you want to hear all this nonsense?
Yep.
Okay, when I got there, it was this little young kid that kept me there all night from about 12 o'clock on to around 7 o'clock in the morning. Okay. And so this young kid came in around about 7. He couldn't look at me. He had his head down like that, you know. He kept looking. He'd look away. So finally I said, just tell me what it is. I can handle it. So you know, he said, get your affairs in order.
Huh?
I laughed. You know, I mean, what doctor or something like that.
I can't hear because you'd sue him for some kind of stress or something. You
well, he was stressed out, not me.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
He was messed up.
They'll never tell you.
But that's what he told me. So I asked, I made him tell me exactly what you're talking about. He said, we found the spot on your lungs. So, okay. So he told me that I'll go see your doctor. He will tell you where to go from there. So I did. He sent me to a specialist, looked at my lungs. He came in laughing because I guess he had heard what the doctor said. He came in laughing. And now I'm mad at him because you come in laughing. This is something pretty serious, I thought, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, no, I'm not laughing. You were just laughing what he's told you. I said, you think that's funny? He said, oh, no, it's not funny, but we're not ready to worry about that just yet. And I said, what did you mean? He said, well, there is something on your lungs. True enough, we don't know what it is. We can't tell. So he said, we are lucky that we even know there's something there because normally you don't find that on the lungs until it's too late. So he sends me to do a CAT scan. Still couldn't tell. Then about a week later, 2 weeks later, I did a PET scan. Still couldn't tell. Then they did what they cut a biopsy. They took those things, stick it inside your and grab a piece of it. Still couldn't tell. So about a month later, he calls me in and tells me, said, the last CAT scan you took, that meant that you had to do something. You just couldn't. So he put me on the table, sent it down to the lab, cut a piece out, sent it to the lab. It's cancerous. And he told me that he got it all, you know, that the lymph glands were clear, you know, and that expect anything. I didn't have to go through no treatment, no other treatment. Just every 6 months I get a CAT scan. And every time I've had a second bypass, just a nick of time, you know. But that's what I'm saying. I get a warning. I listen. Me and my subconscious on
turn. Where? Yeah.
Me and him, we go way back. But that's why I'm still here. I actually listen.
You stay tuned in to yourself. Yeah.
You know?
Good.
So what's next for you? This show that we're sitting in the middle of.
I have no idea. I can tell you this, that I'm supposed to be doing something down at the Finney Center.
Oh, really?
The Cultural Center there. You know, I'm supposed to be doing something there. I might end up trying to complete that and do some paintings there. The only thing I would take, that one in the middle, the big one, I would take down there. Everything else can be finished in my studio if I have to. You know, I'll probably paint some, you know. I'm always collecting some of these crazy mirror frames, fairly old, you know, and the better. It means it has character to me, at least, you know. And it forced you to create a composition that you probably wouldn't think about. So I got a bunch of those things at the house. I'm going to start filling them up. Things, I think. I don't have a theme that is too early for me to theme and think about a theme, you know.
Yeah.
I suspect that it's going to be a further continuation of this thing here. I just think that, you know, the only... There's two really, really bad things in this world that's happening to us now. One is climate change. The other one is racism. Racism, COVID can't hold a candle to racism.
Mm-hmm.
It can't even hold a candle. This thing is all over the world. In almost every place where there's been a war or people have been massacred, it's because one dominant group is trying to take advantage. They create hatred toward one group.
Mm-hmm.
All of us like that. There's no wars are just popped up out of no place.
Yeah.
Hitler, it's just crazy, you know. So I just keep on going with what I do, you know, and idea will come when it's ready. I think it's trying to trend toward this thing of kids with power. You know, I'm working two more. The one I'm working on, I'm going to call that Newborn. That's the name of that one. And then one, there's no name for one with the
doing that. The butterflies. You know, I'm thinking of Opia.
She's doing.
She's doing good. She's in Texas. She was one of my friends. And she used to do... She does nails, so she's creating. She's still creating, but she used to draw butterflies. Every time we were in class with Mr. Jeter, he would be like, you pick what you want to draw, and she would draw butterflies.
Yeah, she would.
Mm-hmm.
You knew Amina too, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Amina,
yeah.
She's just off there. She's out there. You know, you see her sometime on Facebook, and I look like she's singing or something, you know? Mm-hmm. Is she actually doing music now?
Mm-hmm. You got to tell them, who was your best student? I'm just saying, I'm not going to put you on the spot like that.
I can tell you who I thought had most potential.
Okay.
It was you.
Really?
I did. Mm. Why do you think I didn't spend so much time with you? Trying to get you, because I had to get through all that nonsense in your head.
Yeah.
But I thought you had some good potential. I still remember that one piece with it. I was a doc or something, wasn't it? It's vague in my head. A painting you did.
I did a painting of pumpkins.
Yeah, there was one also, I think, of a little dock or something, and there was water. You know?
Oh, yeah. It was a nice charcoal painting. Piece.
It was a painting, I think. It was a
painting?
I thought it was. Well, I mean, you have to forgive me. You should remember all your work. I remember less and less and less every day. I thought you had great potential. The one that fulfilled himself was Daniel. Linda's doing a lot at that, too, you know. She still works full-time. You know, that's about, she probably, well, Daniel's probably the hardest worker we've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's the student with the most potential, you know. That's as messed up in the head as the rest of us, you know.
Yeah.
I just tend to be a little bit off at times. And Daniel's, he's very emotional, you know, about everything, you know, but what can he draw? He went to that school up in New York, the Academy of Figurative.
Mm-hmm.
He got a scholarship there. From Benedict College, got a
scholarship. Wow. That's a
very difficult place to even get into. And when he graduated, he got an award to go, what was it, Thailand or someplace to study for paint just
wow.
6 weeks.
See, something. Anything is possible.
We couldn't, you know, like try to get people to go outside of, you know, to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult to get them to leave home. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a state quite like this where students would not leave home. And leave my mama.
It's a culture.
And I asked him, I said, well, I wouldn't ask them that, but what kind of mothers that will encourage you to stay here when you have an opportunity to go out and better yourself, you know? I don't know, but I guess they would like that and they just passed on their kids, you know?
That just makes me think of that piece right there.
Mm-hmm. About a father who never quit, you know? Still trying to teach. This is, all this stuff is speculating that the pandemic hold. We are really suffering. Everybody's really suffering. So if you look at this, you see on the street, mm-hmm. New York, that mm-hmm. represents the people that really are responsible for all of this stuff. You
yeah.
know? And all these people dying is because of them. Greed, you know. So that talks about them, that living just enough. You know where that's from, don't you? Boy!
Living's just enough
for the city. You ever heard that?
Mm-mm.
Stevie Wonder.
Oh.
We're going to have to educate
her. Yeah, because you 90.
Yeah.
Yes.
But they all in the rap.
Yeah, she's 90.
Oh, they're not into good music. They
yeah, 90.
Okay,
stuff, you know?
It's time to wrap it up. It's time to wrap it up. Y'all coming for me.
It's time to wrap it up. It's just getting good, isn't it?
It's different because, I don't know, like, when you a certain age, those things matter. And at a certain age, it doesn't. I always think about, like, you being the same generation as Kevin and I, but 90 is, like, sister's generation.
I'm mature.
And there's a
I'm an old soul.
But there's a big difference between that era
that
and all of a sudden
mad.
We could steal everything.
Yeah.
It was like causing Napster and whatever else happened. Lime. Like all of a sudden, like it didn't matter what was popular right now. We were listening to everything.
We heard the music too, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, some of the things these people, look at the OJs. I bet you haven't heard those really slow tunes they used to sing. You and Me. Oh. Go and get the Survival record. It's Survival. You can probably find it online. Survival by the OJs.
Yeah.
You listen to that stuff. Ah, it was our tunes we listened to. It was with our girlfriends. Your favorite girl? Singing that stuff? Oh, amazing. OJs. And all these people. The old Temptations, the first ones.
The first ones, yeah. Okay.
The first.
You know, you didn't even know what Temptation is.
No, I know what the Temptations are, but I didn't know you talking about the old ones. Or...
Well, you watched the movie, right?
Yeah, I seen the movie.
Like they still tour now. I think when Temptation left.
I was the only one alive.
Yeah, no, my friends got mad at me because I didn't know what they were talking
the
about.
Was pretty good.
The oldest part.
Oh, yeah. Nobody ever come to see you, Otis.
Nobody. When I said that, I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah. But this was a good episode. Thank you, Mr. Jeter.
You guys close down the office. You know that, don't you? They leave it for.
Oh,
it's okay.
We enjoyed
just
this episode.
Seven or so, you know.
This is going to go down in the books.
We are
and I definitely cannot wait to see the full exhibit. What's the date?
Well,
the last date it'll be here?
The 20th.
September? Or
no, it's
August 20th?
Close.
Okay, mm-hmm. August 20th.
I know they were talking about doing something, but since they're doing this thing with my daughter, they were talking about a closing of some sort.
A closing reception.
We had an opening for it. But this was not meant to be an exhibition in the typical, you know, traditional sense. This was meant to be in an artist studio.
Yeah.
That's why you see the place is changing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I look like my studio now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what it was meant to be. So it was designed to encourage people to come in to talk.
Okay.
You know, unfortunately, people in, they say it's more than they ever got in this gallery, you know, but we're not getting black artists. They're
yeah.
not coming. I don't know why that is. I think that there's something about the arts. A lot of young white artists not coming either. Mostly older artists is coming, you know,
mm-hmm.
but it's something about, I don't know if this is true or not, but it seems true that young artists don't feel like they need anything that went before them. You can find that in music also, you know, that you ask one, you know who John Coltrane is.
Yeah.
You know, these guys, you can't do music without knowing who Coltrane is, not the saxophone. You know?
Yeah. Research, they don't need any of that history behind
don't
it.
Don't need any. And so they would treat me like an old head that whose time has passed, you know. And I think I'm very contemporary.
He needs a gallery.
Yeah.
You need a gallery.
Yeah.
You need a gallery. There's only a few people can actually make it that way, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
You know, Insta money ain't real money.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing with me is that I go see anybody's work, just see the art. I don't have to know the person.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
See if they actually know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear about the work. And, you know, this will probably be the last time we'd be able to see my work. Because
that's why I had to get this interview. Yeah. I said, Mr. Jesus.
Because I don't plan to do any more shows here. It's I don't think it's really worth my time anymore, you know.
You mean in the state?
Yeah. Well, I mean in Columbia.
Oh, okay.
And if they won't come here, they certainly are not going to leave Columbia to see me. You know, they won't come here. I'm a former student, you know.
Yeah.
We're going to wrap
this
it up.
A really nice show. Right?
Yeah, we're going to wrap it up and make sure you guys check out Mr. Jeter's work. Where can they find you on social media or website?
TyroneJeter.com.
Tyrone Jeter.
Website, TyroneJeter.com.
And we just want to say thank you to 701 Whaley for definitely letting us use this place to do this episode. Just to wrap things up, thank you again, Mr. Jeter. It's been a pleasure. And make sure you guys follow us and like all of our stuff on social media. And make sure you subscribe. Good one.
Glad that's done.
That's it for today's episode of the Hilltop Glove Podcast.
Make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and other platforms.
Also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Hilltop Glove.